Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to explore some unique people and happenings in Iowa history. Later in the hour, I'll talk with historian Leo Landis about an extraordinary map of Iowa history created by Mildred Peltzer in 1934. And then we'll learn about Belle Babb Mansfield, the first woman lawyer in the United States born near Burlington. But first, the state of Iowa is 175 years old this year. And of course, today our borders are familiar and mostly fixed, but it took quite a while for them to get that way. Paul Anderson is professor emeritus at Iowa State University in the departments of landscape, architecture, and agronomy, and he happens to also be an amateur historian and expert on the history of Iowa's border. Hello, Paul.
Good to be with you.
Wonderful to have you here. And Paul, where did your interest in Iowa's border start?
Well, I've been studying the landscape history of Iowa as part of my responsibilities at Iowa State University. In particular, I studied the early section line and section corner surveys because those maps and field notes told us what the historic vegetation was like. And we have a number of agencies, particularly Iowa Department of Natural Resources, Iowa DNR, and then quite a few county conservation boards that are managing land and needed to know what the historic landscapes were like. Well, in the process of reading those early maps and field notes, those were 1832 to 1859, I ran into some information about Iowa borders. On the north, we have a surveyed line, on the south, a surveyed line. So on the east and west, rivers. We first think of Mississippi River on the east and Missouri River on the west, but we have two other short reaches of river, Big Sioux River northwest, north of Sioux City, and a bit of the Des Moines River southeast. And those were borders also, but they all presented some problems.
Yeah, and we will talk in just a couple of minutes about a flood that caused a really unusual border characteristic over in western Iowa. Let's talk about those survey lines for a few minutes, though. Let's start up north. Tell me how that line came to be.
The northern border was probably the least controversial, although there were four or five different locations for the northern border of Iowa. This is discussions that took place between the creation of the territory in 1838 and statehood about 8 years later. And those discussions ended up in U.S. Congress in the Senate Committee on Territories, and that was headed up, chaired by Stephen A. Douglas, and that's the same Douglas that we heard about when we studied the Abraham Lincoln Stephen Douglas debates. But he was the one who settled on a border, northern border, that would be surveyed by Army surveyors. And the idea was to begin about 1850, but that was delayed 2 years by the third worldwide cholera pandemic. So they didn't get started surveying as soon as they wanted to, but by the time they got started in 1852, they had a good organization. They had that survey crew of 42, and those would include about 14 surveyors. And they had an incentive. If they finished within a year, their pay was increased $1 a day.
Wow. So they really made good time. And that survey line didn't lead to any major disputes.
No, that was one that the only one of the four, north, south, east, or west, that didn't end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. All the others had multiple Supreme Court cases because of the complications.
All right, let's talk about some of the complications at our southern border, which is where I think the most fireworks flew. And that started in a similar way with a survey line that seemed pretty straightforward. What happened?
Well, 1816, John Sullivan was instructed to start at the confluence of the Kansas River and the Missouri River, and think of Kansas City, present-day Kansas City, in that location. And a nice round number was picked out of the air, and he was instructed to survey straight north for 100 miles. And then go east directly to the Des Moines Rapids. Now, that was a source of confusion right away, because apparently a lot of people knew about the Des Moines Rapids being in the Mississippi River, at the mouth of the Des Moines River, but others didn't know. So one of the things that happened to him is he stopped short. He was looking in the Des Moines River, which he ran into before the Mississippi. This would be in southeast corner of Iowa. And he apparently never could find the Des Moines Rapids, which were in the Mississippi River, but they were just north of or upriver, a few miles from the mouth of the Des Moines River. So that was a source of confusion and led to some resurveys and a couple of court cases. And it didn't get any better from then. There were other lines, state borders that were proposed, because Sullivan also made a mistake in terms of adjusting his compass on his survey compass instrument. And that meant that he was not quite in the right place or in the intended place. So the U.S. Supreme Court considered four different options, and they finally decided to go with the original Sullivan survey.
Well, and then more confusion was caused by the fact that that land along the Missouri border was really desirable land. So Missouri wanted to claim a line that was further north. Iowa wanted to claim a line that was further south. And not only was it really fertile farmland, but also there were trees that contained honeybee hives. And so that was something people really wanted access to.
Very valuable at the time as a sweetener. And Missouri apparently found some honey trees and cut them down so he could have access to all the honey that was in there. And turned out that was north of the Sullivan line, but south of the area that, or part of the area that Missourians thought was part of the state of Missouri. So there were some tempers that flared up, and the Missouri militia gathered in that area. And by the time the Iowa militia found out about it, and reached the area, the Missouri militia had fled. And apparently a few of the officers stayed and did some negotiation, but the militia members, some 1,500, I understand, they had disappeared by that time. So that was called the Honey War, also a bloodless war, because not a shot was fired.
And it sounds like maybe it was more of a big drunken party than any kind of war.
Yes, and another aspect of that was double taxation. People who lived in this twilight zone, the disputed territory, which was about 2 million acres, by the way, people who lived in that area were visited by two tax collectors, one from Iowa and one from Missouri.
I can only imagine how popular that was. And Paul, before we run out of time, I do want to talk briefly about the rivers and Carter Lake, Iowa, which is a little town that is in Nebraska. And that is one of those places where the fact that there was flooding and that rivers are always changing course, the history of that area was changed by a flood, right?
1877 flood. Yeah. And while it looks like it's in Nebraska, it's not. It's in Iowa. But it's west of...
But it's on the western side of the Missouri River.
The main channel of the Missouri River. Yeah. But of course, when the river changes its course, it gets confusing. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, as a general rule, state boundaries will follow gradual changes in the course of a river. But when there's a major change, and they call that a vulsing, that's a geological word or hydrologic word that means a cutoff has been formed. It's a major change. The U.S. Supreme Court says the state boundaries don't change like they would with a gradual change. So that ended up to be two or three U.S. Supreme Court cases. And the latest one that I could find was 1972. So that was an issue before the Supreme Court from 1892 to 1972.
Wow. Well, and given how volatile our weather is now, it'll be interesting to see how our borders change in the future. Paul, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Paul Anderson is professor emeritus at Iowa State University in the departments of landscape, architecture, and agronomy, and he's an expert on Iowa's border history. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about Belle Babb Mansfield, the first woman lawyer in the United States, born near Burlington. But first, some remarkable work done by another Iowa woman. Her name was Mildred Peltzer, and she created a highly detailed artistic map of Iowa featuring many events in Iowa history. She completed her work in 1934, and here to tell us about it is Leo Landis, state curator of the State Historical Society in Des Moines. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And I think the place to start is by describing this remarkable map. It is really, truly a work of art. Can you put it into words for us to really try to capture what this map is?
Sure. It's one person's take, of course, on Iowa history from 1934. Mildred Peltzer was an artist who was born in Wisconsin, grew up in Montana, and then married Louis Peltzer of University of Iowa, who was a history professor. And so she was trained with Marvin Cohn and Grant Wood, but recognizing that Iowa was approaching a centennial in 1936, and also the towns of Dubuque and Burlington were approaching centennials in the early 1930s, she wanted to depict, she thought it was important to depict important Iowa events in an artistic form. So she called it her Prairie Chronicles and Pictures, and she worked with history faculty at Iowa and also with the State Historical Society. And we have a copy both in Des Moines and in Iowa City. And Mary Bennett, my colleague in Iowa City, told me about it. So has every county seat. So you've got 100 items there, but then covers events, some forgotten, some that we know since it's 1934. You see Herbert Hoover as president. You see some of the standard things like the state capitals and the territorial capitals and the different secretaries in the U.S. cabinet, like E.T. Meredith or the Wilson, or excuse me, James Wilson, but also a lot of underrepresented stories. Though, truth be told, it's great on women's, or I shouldn't say great, it's solid on women's history, Black history, and other immigrant history not so well represented.
Sure. And she writes a little note at the bottom of the map that I think is lovely. I mean, it sounds like she sees the fun in this, but yet it's also a very serious chronicle. She writes, here is the tracery made by pioneer hands for 100 years in a place that is Iowa. Here is the record in pictures, exclamation point. I mean, it almost feels a little cartoony.
That's exactly right. Or that's an excellent description. And so you do the images. She was a well-known artist. She did WPA murals in Iowa, also murals at the Jefferson Hotel in Iowa City. So she was a well-known artist, but it's nice to call it playful today if you're looking at it from a history standpoint. You know, there had been events in our state's history that you say, why isn't that represented? That certainly were significant. You think of like the case of Ralph that was ruled in Burlington in 1839, our first Iowa Supreme Court case that says Blacks have rights, and was a major court ruling, and yet that's not recognized. Yeah. And so things that are fun and engaging and important are on there, and also stories that are overlooked too, that are worth remembering sometimes.
Which definitely gives us some insight into the time and the way that people saw the world, especially white people who were in the majority. It's very possible she didn't see those as significant historical events, although we know, of course, that they are significant and important historical events, that it feels like they should be part of this map. Although she also recognizes, she shares, again, more lighthearted things as well, but she does say, your favorite local legend is no doubt forgotten. So she was also very aware that as much as she packed into this map, and it is packed, that there was so much that she couldn't do.
Yeah, and I think one of my favorite stories that I discovered in looking at it is the recognition of Dixie Wilson. She was the older sister of Meredith Wilson, and in 1934, much more well-known. She was a nationally known author. She had done magazine articles for national magazines, but also in 1923 did a book called Honey Bear that's a little sing-songy, rhymy book, and it was a well-known children's book in the period. And in fact, then the national author Tom Wolfe, who goes to Yale and does an interview with Yale, says it was the book Honey Bear by Dixie Wilson of Mason City that inspired him to be an author. So there's a great story that I did not know. I bet most Iowans don't know, where Dixie Wilson does her book Honey Bear, and it's in the public domain now. So you can find it through Hottie Trust and read it, a beautiful children's book. And the fun part about it, too, is that Maginal Wright Barney, who had a brother, Frank Lloyd Wright, does the illustrations for it, too. So you've got Dixie Wilson, who had a well-known brother, and then Maginal Wright, who also had a well-known brother, but had achievements in their own right.
Well, and you mentioned that this map is pretty solid on women's history, which very few sources in 1934 were. And you have to imagine that that was intentional on Margaret Pelzer's part.
I certainly think so. And she did. She consulted a number of different historians, as we said. And so she was good at looking for women's rights, though I looked hard, and I still can't find Amelia Bloomer over in Council Bluffs, but she certainly recognizes women in arts and literature, and then also Carrie Lane Chapman Catt Carrie Chapman Catt's work on women's suffrage too is recognized. But a lot of those stories, as we said, like Dixie Wilson, that are forgotten today, are people that are referenced on the map now.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about a couple of the other people, like Josephine Donovan. Tell me about her.
Yeah, that's another, as we said, a story that's not as well known today. But in 1930, she had done a book called The Soil, and that's out of a story, you know, Pelzer's really good on doing immigrant stories, and so recognizes a lot of different ones. But Josephine Donovan of Granville up in northwest Iowa, Granville, just a little west of, east of Sioux City and Orange City area, and does a book called Black Soil that talks about the Irish farming communities in northwest Iowa. And so another, again, well-known woman's author of the period who today isn't as recognized as, you know, some other women authors from Iowa. So stories of immigrants are things that she covers. You know, you've got the Norwegians in the Decorah area, Czechs in Spillville, Irish in northwest Iowa and Emmitsburg, and of course Dutch in Pella and Orange City. So some great stories connected to immigrants too.
Well, and on the map, there are these little vignettes, and then she also puts larger banners on the map. So marking off the northeastern corner of the state, here is the Switzerland of Iowa, for example. And you know, you mentioned recognizing the places where immigrants tended to settle and gather with people who had come from the same home country. And that's something that she marks on the map as well. And do we know how long it took her to do this?
She started talking about it by 1932 and 1933. So she worked on it, I would presume, off and on for about a year in her work. And you know, to her credit, too, talking about immigrant groups, she talks about Native Nations, mostly in removal.
Yeah.
But she does a nice job of incorporating the Meskwaki settlement, doesn't draw their appropriate lodges, puts them in teepees, which the Meskwaki didn't use, but she at least acknowledges that the Meskwaki had bought land in Tama County in 1856, 1857. So she does incorporate that story pretty well.
Well, and even in recognizing the removal of indigenous people from the land, that's something that was ignored in a lot of histories. Not that she can do it justice in this map format, but I think it's important that it's part of the map and at least shows an understanding of how the state came to be what it is. Are there immigrant stories that kind of surprised you on the map?
You know, one that I had forgotten about that I've seen at different times is the Hungarian immigrants. Laszlo Uhazi was a Hungarian patriot. The people of Hungary, some people in Hungary in 1848, 1849 were working at overthrowing the monarchy and making it more of a republic. And so they had strong support in the United States. But when the effort fails, a number of Hungarians under Laszlo Uhazi tried to establish a community in southern Iowa in Decatur County called New Buda, and it gets support from the federal level. One of our senators, George Wallace Jones, gets the post office set in New Buda. There's talk that Kossuth, the Hungarian patriot, will be moving to Iowa, and we've got Kossuth County, of course, up in the northern part of the state, named for him, but that he will come. And just because of issues connected to land acquisition, the Hungarian community in Decatur never really takes off. And that's a story, though, with New Buda being an official town in Decatur County, is one that is often overlooked today, too.
You also can find a story about British immigrants in Lamars that I had never heard of. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And this is one, again, that the map is good at reminding you of stories you may have heard or like seen a reference to. And William B. Close, who was Oxford educated in England and is looking for opportunities for land investment, then sees that there has been a number of disruptions to settlement, primarily through grasshoppers coming through western Iowa and northwest Iowa, especially in the 1870s and 1880s. And so British start buying land in northwest Iowa. And so up in Lamar's, William B. Close then starts a community, and it becomes being a well-educated British person, he creates the Lamar's Polo Club, which is it's the first polo club west of Philadelphia, west of the Mississippi River, and it's regionally, if not nationally, known. They are good polo players coming out of Lamar's in the 1880s and 1890s, so are regarded as some of the best polo players in the United States in Lamar's, Iowa, in the late 1880s, early 1890s.
Wow. Are we still playing polo in Lamar's, do you think?
Well, actually, a few years ago, like the late 20-teens, there was a resurrection of playing polo. So there's some stories out there on the internet. If you want to Google it, both historically, do an internet search, and you will find historic stories. But also, I think it was a 2018 match that took place to recognize that history. So it hasn't totally been forgotten, but most of us have forgotten it.
I also enjoy some of the businesses that are mentioned on the map. Of course, there's farming, and we've got the great popcorn center in Sac City or near Sac City.
Yep.
And in Charles City, we've got a tractor factory.
Correct. And also recognizes, you know, the industry in Waterloo, too. But Charles City, of course, is where Hart Parr, Charles Hart, Charles Parr start their business. They were Charles Hart is an Iowan. They both had gone to University of Wisconsin and then come to Iowa to start their tractor factory, and they coined the term tractor. Tractors were made in Charles City into the 1970s, but the Hart Parr Company was the first company to really use that term tractor. Before that, they were called gasoline traction engines in many cases. So that's another great story that's important to our state today, but also talks about the foundations of Iowa industries as well.
There's also a fish farm near Wachier. Tell me about that one.
Sure. Down in Thornburg, which is just near Wachier in Keokuk County, the Bruce family, which had come out of the Pittsburgh area, came to Iowa in the 1870s, and they had done goldfish fisheries and when they were out east, and then decide that Iowa is a better opportunity. Their first or second year, their crop of goldfish was lost when ducks ate about 3,000 of the goldfish in 1878, 1879. But through the late 1800s into the 1930s, it's producing hundreds of thousands of goldfish a year and being the major supplier. So it is a national register site today, the Bruce Goldfish Fisheries, just down in Keokuk County. I'm being in central Iowa, I'm saying down. So another really important story for a period that is largely forgotten today.
Well, and that's interesting because she was trying to capture 100 years of history on this map, but it also is very much a time capsule of the moment in time in which she was creating it, isn't it?
It is, and that's why I think, you know, people like Dixie Wilson, who certainly is important today, is placed on that map, but would be forgotten today because it's not a story that has persisted or perhaps overshadowed by her brother. And so we think of Mason City and Meredith Wilson and the Music Man, but forget the great work and the important work done by Dixie Wilson. So we're fortunate that she has documented some of those stories that are both important today and overlooked.
I have thoroughly enjoyed exploring this map, and where can other people see it if they want to spend some time and zoom in and try to read all of these little vignettes?
Sure. It was done as a project with the State Historical Society, so I've shared it with your producer, Rick Brewer, and hopefully he can get it out there or they can reach out to me. Also, it's in our Iowa's People and Places exhibit at the State Historical Building. We're open Tuesdays through Fridays, 9 to 4:30, so guests can see it there as well.
All right. Well, there is so much to see and think about with this map. And Leo, I know that you are in the midst of celebrating the 175th anniversary of the state of Iowa. So I'm sure we will talk again as we mark that year as well. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Charity.
Leo Landis is state curator of the State Historical Society of Iowa. We've been talking about a truly remarkable map made by artist Mildred Peltzer. It was published or completed in 1934. And coming up in just a moment, we'll learn about another remarkable Iowa woman, Belle Babs Mansfield, who was the first woman lawyer in the United States. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about some exceptional moments in Iowa history, and now we're going to learn about another extraordinary woman. Her name was Arabella Babb Mansfield, but she went by Belle. She was born near Burlington the year that Iowa became a state, and she became the first woman in the nation to pass the bar exam in 1869. She was a graduate of Iowa Wesleyan University, and here to tell us more about her is Jeff Meyer, e-resources and instruction librarian at the Chadwick Library at Iowa Wesleyan University. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Belle Babs Mansfield, she was born near Burlington, but she didn't stay in Iowa very long. Tell me just a little bit about her childhood.
Yeah, Belle is a world traveler, and her adventures begin very early when she's a child. Her father, Miles, is actually going to take the family from Des Moines County near Burlington in 1850. They're going to go to California and go to the gold rush. So she, as a young child, as a four-year-old or five-year-old, is gone across the country in 1850 to the gold rush. And a few years after they've been there in 1852, her father, Miles, is actually killed in a cave-in in California in a gold mine. And so the Babb family is then going to return to Iowa. So Babb and her brother, Washington Irving, they return to Mount Pleasant, which is kind of near their original home in Burlington, just a little bit west.
She pursues her education. Her brother also pursues an education. We don't know a whole lot about that thirst for knowledge that she experienced as a young woman, but she was clearly driven to pursue higher education.
Absolutely. So she's the context of this, you know, it might seem sort of strange that, you know, how would Mount Pleasant or Iowa Wesleyan be the home of the first female attorney in the United States? And Belle Babb really fits into the wider context of Mount Pleasant as the Athens of Iowa. So in the 19th century, Mount Pleasant was founded with very progressive leadership. Right from the get-go, education was the center. As soon as you have those first cabins appearing in 1834 on the frontier, one of the first things the pioneers do is make sure one of the cabins is designated as a school. And in 1842, the future Iowa Wesleyan, the Mount Pleasant Collegiate Institute, is chartered. So within 8 years of the first pioneers being here, we already have a college that's going to be here. And her thirst really fits into the culture that was here in the 19th century. And she does enter college, which was Iowa Wesleyan in Mount Pleasant in 1862. And her brother, the next year, Washington Irving Babb, he also was an Iowa Wesleyan student, but his term at Iowa Wesleyan is interrupted because it's 1863 and he goes to the Civil War in the 8th Iowa Cavalry. But Bell and her brother do receive their degree, their bachelor's degree from Iowa Wesleyan the same year. He comes back from the Civil War in 1865 and continues his education with his sister. So they actually graduate together.
Wow. And how unusual was it for a woman to be studying at Iowa Wesleyan then?
So the education is going to be open to females in actually in a number of institutions in Mount Pleasant. So it's very progressive for the time. But it's going to take a few years before you start to get female students. And it's going to be, first of all, it's rare for anybody in the 19th century to go to college.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're out here on the frontier on the as pioneers, and we already have a university. That sort of shows the direction that this community had taken early on. And she is, you know, one of the earliest, at least, you know, in this part of the country, but really any part of the country in the 1850s to be anybody to go to college, and let alone a female. She's in a very small group of people.
Yeah. So after she graduates, she goes off to teach at Simpson College in Indianola, right?
Yep. She can't stay in one place for too long. She's going to go to Indianola, Iowa, and teach at Simpson College. She's very much into the humanities. So she's going to do English and history. Later on in her life, she's going to get into art history. And then she's going to return back to Mount Pleasant, and she's going to begin studying law. So again, that thirst, that unquenchable thirst for knowledge is going to continue. And there's a law office in the square of Mount Pleasant in 1867 called Ambler's. And she and her brother, Washington Irving, are going to both kind of like study law there. They're going to be mentored there. And then the next year, she's going to marry a professor. And you would imagine that somebody like Belle Babb, that's as intellectually curious as she is, she has to marry a professor. She marries John Mansfield, who's a science professor at Iowa Wesleyan. And the next year, 1869, she's going to actually take the bar exam and pass it she's going to take this at the Union Block building on the north side of the square. So that thirst, unquenchable thirst, continues after her college education. She's not somebody that goes to college, studies hard, and then finishes college and kind of moves on. She is going to be sort of a perpetual student and a perpetual teacher. She's going to learn something, and then she's going to want to teach it.
She did have to sue to be allowed to take the bar exam. So that was not that's a barrier for anybody, but it was certainly not a simple thing for her to do.
Right. So the story with her taking the bar exam is in 1869, the law in Iowa, the code of Iowa has the phrase, white men may apply for the bar. And you can tell that she's going to be a very good lawyer, because she is going to say, just because the law says that white men can apply for the bar, it doesn't say anything about women not being able to. It just says white men can apply. It doesn't say women can't. And the law actually changes the next year, 1870, that clause in the Iowa code that white male persons can apply for the bar, that is stricken from the law. So her actions taking the bar actually forced the law to be changed. And, you know, you can kind of think about Iowa in the 1860s. It makes perfect sense for it to change, because we just been through the Civil War. All these sons of Iowa had gone to the battlefields for freedom and for abolition. And here we had in the Code of Iowa this thing about, you know, white men can apply for the bar. It seems so out of tune with the direction that the state had gone. So Belle Mansfield, after she's married, Belle Babs Mansfield, she not only wins the race in terms of being the first female, but she changes the law in the state. And now in Iowa, with that white male person's clause being stricken, other women are able to apply for the bar.
And I would assume that that being stricken, that also opened opportunities for Black Iowans to pursue this education, eventually at least.
Absolutely. And that's in the spirit of the cause for the Civil War being abolition and the amendments to the Constitution, which abolished slavery and then made all male persons citizens. And then that leads us to her next cause, is that she, in 1870, like, she doesn't stop. She doesn't say, well, I'm a lawyer now and I can practice law and go on my merry way.
Right. And she actually didn't practice law, right?
Right.
She got through the bar, but maybe that was not the point of the exercise. But I'm sorry, go on. She got involved in women's suffrage, right?
Absolutely. She can't be stopped. So she's 1870, the year after she passes the bar. She says, you know what, there's something else we need to work on here, and that's the women's enfranchisement movement, or sometimes known as women's suffrage. So women in 1870 in the United States cannot vote. That won't happen for 50 years. It won't happen until 1920. But here in 1870, 50 years beforehand, Bella Babb Mansfield in Mount Pleasant is chairing a convention. And the convention has seats for 1,000 people. People come from all over the state to Mount Pleasant for the Iowa Women's Enfranchisement Convention. And this leads to the development of the Iowa Women Suffrage Association in the same year. And she's actually going to be a delegate to Des Moines in 1871 for Iowa women's suffrage. So really, really forward thinking.
She continued to pursue her education. She continued to pursue a life as an educator as well. And that she also continued to travel the world. So tell me a little bit about what she did and what she and her husband did in the years that followed her passing the bar exam.
Right. She's just getting started. She has a bachelor's degree. She gets a master's degree. And then in 1872... she's going to actually get the LLB law degree. So she actually becomes a degreed attorney. And then her and her husband in 1872 to 1873, they're going to travel to Europe. They're going to go to the great cities of Europe. They're going to go to London, Paris, Berlin, Vienna, Leipzig. And they're going to see the great centers of learning there. And Professor Mansfield, her husband, the science professor, he wants to see what they're doing in European laboratories because he wants to make Iowa Wesleyan state of the art in terms of the sciences. He wants to have the equipment they would have in a great university in Europe. And when Belle's there, she's going to fall in love with art history. It's sort of hard to go to a city like Paris and not get into art history. It's staring right at you. And so she becomes really fluent in European art history, and she's going to bring all this knowledge back to Iowa Wesleyan when she returns. And her education, her thirst for teaching is going to continue as a professor. She's going to teach at Iowa Wesleyan as her husband does. And then in the 1880s, she's going to get, her and her husband are going to go to the Indiana Asbury University, which is today DePauw, and she's going to teach there. And she's actually going to have sort of a dual life. She's going to teach at DePauw, and then in the summers she's going to come back to Mount Pleasant and also teach classes at Iowa Wesleyan. So she's back and forth, back and forth. In 1893, she becomes the dean of the School of Arts at DePauw. So her name is also there in Indiana.
Her husband suffered from some very serious mental health problems. And, you know, it's easy to look back and try to guess at what was going on in his life, although he was also a veteran of the Civil War, which must have been very difficult. And he struggled with his mental health and basically kind of disappeared into California for a while. He ended up being committed and he passed away in 1894. She carried on, though, after that with her life. She continued to have a very distinguished academic life.
Right. So she did the thing that a lot of people have to do, which is care for an ailing spouse. And then she also maintained her profession. So she's doing the two at the same time. And her world travels are not finished. In 1909, she is going to travel to Japan to study art history in Japan. So she is not limiting herself to just sort of a Western experience. She wants to see the world. And she goes to Japan in behest of DePauw University art history, but she's going to bring that knowledge back to both Indiana and then Mount Pleasant. And with her, her brother is going to be in Aurora, Illinois, and she's going to then become sort of the caretaker there. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of her own life, she's going to be with her brother, and then she's going to die, pass away in 1911 in Aurora, Illinois. So she's really sort of been across the whole country and across the world in her amazing life.
Yeah, what a remarkable woman. And this story was one that was kind of talked about a little bit in Mount Pleasant, but not really confirmed until 1969, right?
Right. So every college town, I think, has its superlatives. We're the first to do that. We're the first to do that. And the primary documentation may or may not actually be there, but it sort of just becomes the local lore. In the 1960s, there's a professor, Lewis Hasselmeyer at Iowa Wesleyan, and he's writing a history of the college, and this kind of came up. He was looking into the both Mansfields, the Mansfield, the husband as a science professor, and then this story that everybody had been talking about his wife, who's also a professor, who was the first female attorney in the United States. And he looked into the primary documentation after he was contacted by the National Association of Women Lawyers. So it's the 1960s. And if she got her degree in 1869, 1969 is going to be the 100th anniversary. He digs into the primary documents, into the old newspapers, and he finds examples from the local newspapers that this, in fact, is true, that it's actually real. It wasn't just something that we're sort of bragging about in Mount Pleasant, but this was acknowledged by the National Association of Women Lawyers. It was acknowledged in a letter from President Nixon in 1969, and also the American Bar Association in 1969 also confirmed it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this history with us today, Jeff.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jeff Meyer, e-resources and instruction librarian at the Chadwick Library at Iowa Wesleyan University. We have been talking about Belle Babb Mansfield. She was the very first woman in the nation to pass the bar exam in 1869, born near Burlington and educated at Iowa Wesleyan University in Mount Pleasant. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.